corporations, to privatizations, to fight against the capitalist system, but also the people who've been facing the most serious levels of police repression in the United States. So this is our chance to hear from people and strategize together about what's it going to take to build a cross-border movement and thinking about what work can be done and what the possibilities are of working internationally. So you can answer in any order that you want, really. Is what has changed about policing or about this idea of state terrorism under neoliberalism, this economic model that puts corporations in bigger positions than even national governments and that supposedly brings down all these barriers to trade and tries, you know, in this free trade, but really ends up giving corporations a really tremendous amount of power. What has changed about the policing and why? That may be the most important question. Why has the policing needed to change because of this different international model that we're all now living under? And that can be in another country or it can be here in our own communities. This is happening everywhere. Yeah.
Well, there will be moments where I will need help translating from you, so just to. Okay, so I don't know how many of you know about El Salvador. So just to mention a little bit of the history of El Salvador and the most recent history, which is, you know, the war, the civil war that most of you have maybe already know about. But at that time, in the 70s and 80s, the strategy that the U.S. and all the corporations used to keep the masses controlled was the military, like the general, el coronel, all of these people with the green uniforms and, you know, all of this huge aparato de represión. And that's how they, you know, they kept people, the idea was to keep people not to fight against the system that have them in poverty or, you know. So after the you know, peace accords in El Salvador in 1992, well, before the 1992, we had this new president that was not, or like, was breaking with the military dictatorships, right? Because he was a civilian. He was not coming from a military background and things like that. So he started with the new strategy, the new kind of model that would be helping to impose the capitalist system or to reinforce the capitalist system in El Salvador. And it had a new name. It was the same thing, but it had a new name, neoliberalism. And the idea was to create the conditions in the country that would allow the companies to come and take over national production, you know, all the capital in the country, all things, and then that's how they, you know, they started the privatizations right at the end of the 80s. They started with the coffee and sugar exports, and then with the imports of oil, and then the big things like La Banca Nacional, I don't know how
National Bank.
National Bank, and then the telecommunications, and that has been, you know, like every year they try to privatize something. And so after the peace accords, which where some people think that the government accepted signing the peace accords because nobody would want to invest in a country with a war, right? Because their investments would be in danger and something. So that's, you know, I don't know, there are a lot of things that people think, but that's one opinion, and I think it makes sense at some point, because after, you know, the peace accords, people were under expectations that they didn't know what would happen next year if the government would complete Conas with the peace accords, they would respect the peace accords. But then the social movement was kind of, you know, like not mobilizing a lot like before, but after they saw how the privatizations started, a lot of people were fired from the public sector, and, you know, unemployment, and that's how migration started to the United States, stronger than other, you know, times. And, you know, all of these things push people to start organizing. And then the social situation became every year worse because of the lack of employment, because of the high cost of living, and because of the, you know, the fact that people heard that there was opportunity in other country, and the youth were not inspired because they couldn't go to the school because their parents didn't have to buy the supplies, or because, you know, they were too far, or things like that. And then studies became more impossible, and then jobs for youth not happening, and then the family separation were the, like, the causes of the el problema actual de las maras.
Mm-hmm.
Entonces,
the current situation with the gangs.
Uh-huh. Entonces, las maras vino a ser para el gobierno como una excusa perfecta, como para buscar ayuda del gobierno de los Estados Unidos para controlar.
So the gangs became, for the Salvadoran government, the perfect excuse to start seeking help, for example, from the U.S. government.
Y entonces fue que empezaron con el gobierno de Francisco Flores, que ha sido desde el 89 hasta la fecha del Partido Arena, que se me olvidó mencionar antes.
So this started really with the President Francisco Flores, who began with the Arena Party, who's been in power in El Salvador since 1989.
Y entonces el creó un programa que se llamaba Mano Dura. Entonces después no funcionó la mano dura contra las maras, crearon la mano super, o la super mano dura. Y así han venido incrementando, y cada vez que le cambian el nombre es porque ellos exponen la necesidad de volver una policía mucho más represiva.
So this started with the policy called the Iron Fist against the gangs. And when that didn't work, then they had to have the Super Iron Fist against the gangs. And so every time that they changed the name, we're really seeing that it's a reason for them to make the police increasingly repressive.
Y entonces realmente el objetivo nunca fue eliminar el problema de las maras, porque yo creo que cualquier, hasta el más tonto, entendería que las maras no es una cuestión de que, de que porque bien chivo andar tirando piedras o andarse matando, sino que, o sea, es un tiene raíz, ¿verdad? Y esa raíz son cosas que el gobierno fue el que preparó el suelo para que existiera ese problema.
So the problem with the that everybody knows that the goal of this was never for the government to actually eliminate the gangs. And nobody thinks that people actually are in the gangs because it's really cool to go around throwing rocks, or it's really cool to go around killing people. There's actually very, very deep roots to the gangs, and it has to do a lot with how the government really prepared and laid the groundwork for them to exist and continue.
Mm-hmm. Y bueno, y eso no es algo que nosotros nos inventamos o por hacer el cuento más interesante, sino que hay, por ejemplo, ahora imprimimos una lista de gente del movimiento social, líderes de sindicatos, líderes estudiantiles, activistas del partido de izquierda que han sido asesinados. Y
so this isn't something that we've invented or made up to make the story sound more interesting. At this point, and I have a list that I printed here, is a list of social movement leaders and activists. So union leaders, student leaders, members from the leftist party in El Salvador who have all been assassinated recently.
Y son aproximadamente 24 los que se han reportado desde el 2006, ¿verdad? Son los que se han reportado, son los que la gente dice, miren, esto está pasando. Y todo lo excusan en la cuestión de las maras o del narcotráfico, la delincuencia común. Entonces son, ahí se ponen en evidencia, ¿verdad? Todo lo que hemos venido hablando desde hace años, de que el objetivo de militarizar la policía, que fue producto de los acuerdos de paz, y que eso es una clara violación a los acuerdos de paz, el hecho de militarizar, que el objetivo es apagar o controlar cualquier movimiento social que venga a resistir la imposición del neoliberalismo y del modelo, de este modelo neoliberal que los Estados Unidos está imponiendo y que claramente está destruyendo el país.
So this is a list of 24 people who've been killed since March 2006, and this is only the ones that have been reported. That's 24, only the ones that have been reported that people have come forward and said, this is what's happening. So this is some evidence, this is the evidence that shows us that, you know, the real purpose of militarizing the police that were formed at the end of the war during the peace accords, and so by militarizing them is actually a violation of those peace accords, but that the real purpose of militarizing the police has been to put down any sort of resistance or social movement that comes to challenge this neoliberal model that is imposed by the United States and that's really destroying everything.
Bueno, y
And just that the excuse of all of these killings has been something to do with the gangs, with narco trafficking, with drug trafficking, with common delinquency. It's all been blamed on youth violence.
Bueno, ya para terminar, solo mencionar, ¿verdad? Y es algo que Alexis explicó al principio sobre la ILEA y sobre la militarización y los planes México y todo eso, que eso viene a ser como el hecho de reforzar la policía es la nueva cara de la democrática que le están poniendo a la represión, porque ya pasó de moda lo de los militares, lo de Pinochet, lo de Davison y lo de todos estos botudos, y entonces ahora van a poner a los cachuchudos, que son la policía, que la gente acepta porque son la protección civil, ¿verdad? Porque los militares ya no, ya se descubrió que son corruptos, pero estamos viendo otra vez esta inclinación hacia lo militar y lo represivo que nosotros ya no vamos a aceptar. Y ya con eso termino.
So, like Alexis was saying in the beginning, with everything that has to do with the ILEA, with the Plan Mexico, that it's coming to be that the way of reforming the police is the way of giving a new democratic face to the same repression, because it's in the past, everything with military repression and with dictators like Pinochet and Dalbison, that's in the past. All of those guys with their boots and their hats, that's the repression of the past. So now, they're using the police to take on that same role because the police are going to be accepted by the people because they're supposedly their civilian protectors. The military were discovered to be corrupt, so now it's the police that we're supposed to trust. So nonetheless, it's still the same mechanisms of militarizing the police now to take on that repression, which is something we will not accept. Repression. Not that that's in nutshell, Tavi, but I know that you have a lot to talk about.
I think both Yenny and Wilson have already, you know, well, especially Yenny has covered that one pretty well. I would just add that in addition to the police forces that are connected with government, we also have privatized police now. And we've got Blackwater, and what's the other one? The name escapes me off the top, but there's another big biggie. Does anybody recall the name?
Dyncorp,
right, thank you. So we've got these, Blackwater is already set up, if I'm not mistaken, its headquarters in San Diego, okay? And they comprise about half the forces in Iraq right now. There's something like 180,000 or something like that, I forget. But it's up there. So when the disparities in wealth are as gross and as incredible as they are, the greatest in history, you know, with about 1% of the global population owns 80% of the world's resources. So when these disparities are this gross, then people begin to rise up, because when people get hungry and they see all this wealth in government and among the elite, then they rise up. So in order to quash the potential revolutionary movements of the people, both domestically and internationally, they have to have police forces in place and the military in place, ready to arrest. And of course, this jibes with the fact that the U.S. is the number one incarcerator in the world. They have some 7 million people today on some form of penal control, 2.4 million in prison. And of course, I'm not even sure, and somebody please help me, if those numbers reflect the detainees, the immigrant detainees who are locked into detention centers, as they are referred to.
Doesn't include those.
It doesn't, does it? So we don't even know. That's a low figure. That's a conservative figure, no doubt. Okay? So we have this huge, we haven't even touched on the ICE raids and all that. And I guess that's coming up, huh?
No, go ahead. Oh, well. Come on.
Well, in any case, you know, when you have, I can't resist saying pigs, I'm sorry. When you have, you have pigs running amok in people, you know, in neighborhoods, terrorizing families the way they're terrorizing families in Iraq. The same shit. I mean, the same thing. Separating children from their parents. The kids come home from school and their parents are gone, locked up somewhere. I mean, this is insane. And I don't understand myself why the American people are not just up in arms about this. I can only say that those ordinary, everyday working people are just too busy working three jobs to support their families to be able to rise up. And then there's that segment of people, like some people close to me, who have their heads in the sand and don't want to know anything about what's going on. Don't tell me. I'm not interested. I don't want to know. All I want to know about is entertainment and sports. So we have a dilemma. We have a job to do. We have to wake people up, and we have to wake them up in a hurry, because I feel strongly that with this crisis, this economic, global economic crisis in our faces, we have a choice we can either help the house of cards fall down, you know, if you don't hit it, it won't fall, and help it, help capitalist imperialism collapse and replace it with real socialism, or we can let this, these fascists socialize the losses that they've made, right, and continue to privatize all their profits and continue to, I mean, we will just be bailing out billionaires if we let this $700 billion plan go through. I think that we should be taking to the streets, the airwaves, writing letters to the editors, calling the creeps in Congress, doing everything in our individual and collective power to stop these dogs from doing what they're about to do, which is to bail out all these criminals. And I'll stop there.
Well, that leads us really nicely into the other big question that we have for all the panelists is the how. What are we going to do? Seeing how increasingly transnational the companies are, how increasingly mobile their capital and profits are, how increasingly transnational the police are, training together, out on patrol together, working together, sharing information about potentially all of us soon, if not already. What do we do next? How, and knowing, you know, thinking about the fact they're using the same rhetoric in San Francisco to put police officers on every corner, that this is, you know, a war on gangs. Same exact rhetoric they're using in Mexico. So we see the similarities, and yet we haven't been able to come yet to this vision of some sort of cross-border unified resistance. What does that look like? So the questions of the panelists are, what strategies are already being done and that are working? What more do we need to do? What needs rethinking or reworking? What do we do? It's an easy one, I know. Or even just ideas that have been percolating.
Yes. I'm a solution-oriented person, I'll tell you. Well, I think that, well, let me backtrack just a little bit. I said something about revolution to somebody just recently, and they came in, well, are you talking about armed struggle? No, I'm not talking about armed struggle. You have babies crawl before they walk, before they run, you know what I mean? We're in an infantile stage of struggle in this country. We really are. The movement is in the doldrums. We have to start over. And it seems to me that the very first task of a revolution, and I'm not the one who thought of this, I think it was Mao, is to distinguish between enemies and friends. Okay, now that's a toughie in America. Mm-hmm. Who are our real friends, our real enemies? That's the first task. And we can just look around this room and know that we have friends in this room, and I'm going to assume that everybody in this room is our friend, okay? And we all look very different. Not very different, but kind of different, okay? So do we judge friendship on superficial appearance? Do we decide that, you know, this young brother over here, maybe his complexion is a little darker than I like, so I don't think he's going to be my friend because I'm much lighter than him or something? Or are we going to do just the reverse? I'm much darker and you're too light and I don't like you and I don't trust you because, and then, oh goodness, you're white and you're blonde and you're the enemy. You came from those slavers. You know, that's your heritage. So I don't think I should be friends with you. We can keep on that path, you know, and be crushed, you know, because those water hoses and those guns, they don't discriminate. Or we can come to debate together based on politics. Now, I choose my friends based on politics because I don't want to be hanging out with any fascists. I really don't want to, I don't really care too much for capitalists, exploiters, and greedy guts. Okay, I really prefer people who like to share. I like people, I really love poor people. I don't really care too much for bougies. I'm sorry, that's just me. But, you know, I find a few that I can tolerate, but I think we had better choose our friends based on character, integrity, honesty, loyalty, all that good stuff, right? And come together in a hurry. The second step, I think, once we've distinguished between enemies and friends and gathered our friends, we better start uniting with one another in a hurry, developing coalitions between and among groups. We had a wonderful revolutionary rainbow coalition, I'm here to testify, in the 60s, and it got totally fucked up in the 70s by COINTELPRO, okay? But for a while, it was a high time in the U.S. of A. because people were greeting one another, and I think Wilson's maybe old enough to remember, with the fist, no matter what color. We were sisters and brothers. We were on a move. We were really on a move, and we really
There's
thought we were going to change.
There's a picture of Juan Carlos at the Olympics, the guy's holding
up
his
fist on the wall. There you go, in protest of the Mexican massacre. Okay, so bottom line, we had solidarity, and we can do that again. If we did it, we can do it again. But we should learn from the mistakes that we made, which were legion, but we did a few things right. And one of the things that we did right was organize. We organized our communities to meet their basic needs, and the people loved Panthers. I organized in New Haven, and whenever the pigs were getting ready to vamp on us, we could call a rally like that, and the people would fall out in the street so fast it would make the pigs' heads spin. They couldn't believe that we could call a crowd together as quickly as we could in those days. But it was because the people loved us, we loved the people, because we were organizing them, we were feeding their, helping them feed their kids, we were helping them with free clothing drives, we were organizing rent strikes. Can you even imagine today? Today we have the problem of massive homelessness. Okay, so once we have our friends together, I think that we better grow gardens on every plot of land that we can find. We have to start taking care of each other. I think we will not be able to rely on government and big business, and we may not really be able to rely on any kind of government subsidy or handout or welfare or anything if this whole thing falls apart. So we really have to come, it behooves us to come together in solidarity and just start loving and caring about each other, beginning with our own neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And boycott.
No, 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 no. No to the elections, no to the Walmarts and all these huge monster companies. We don't have to buy their shit. We really don't. And I think that we need to oppose everything they support and support everything they oppose, and we'll probably be all right.
Mm-hmm. Great. Right. Sounds easy. So I think that after you have identified your friends, and you know, I think that talking about the more of a out of the border thing, you know, I think with the movement here has to become more solid, and then also support the movements throughout Latin America and the Middle East and Africa and Asia. Yes, for give a hand to your friends, and you know. And I think that right now I'm going to talk more specifically about El Salvador, because that's, you know what. And I think that right now what CISPES is doing is watching for the elections in El Salvador. watching and denouncing any kind of intervention of the U.S. that it's already happening, right? And, you know, just speaking out. And then after speaking out and doing protests, even if it's just one or two, but next time will be 4 or 5 people, and next time will be 10, next time will be 30, to the Consulado del Salvador, to the federal building, everywhere, you know, everywhere, so people can know, because you will not listen the news, the right news, in the Univision, ABC, NBC, Telemundo, right? You know about it. So you will not hear something that, lo que estábamos hablando del que me dijiste vos, que estaba dando una conferencia y dijo, presionando porque los Estados Unidos debería de intervenir en las elecciones de El Salvador.
So you won't hear like, yeah, there's all these conferences happening, people from El Salvador coming to the U.S. saying you should intervene in the elections in 2004. Please intervene.
In 2009.
In 2009 elections.
So, entonces, CISPES is bringing two delegations to El Salvador, one in January and one in March, to observe the elections in El Salvador and to acompañar el movimiento social en la lucha para llegar al poder, ¿verdad?, por medio de las elecciones, y también para denunciar la intervención estadounidense, para vivir en carne propia la intensidad de la situación en El Salvador en estos tiempos. Y entonces irle restando a los aliados del capitalismo, a los aliados del terrorismo global, ¿verdad? Ya que El Salvador ahorita es uno de los máximos aliados, como es Colombia, como es México, ¿verdad?
Bolivia
ya no.
No.
Con Evo Morales. Entonces, yo creo que esa es por el momento la cuestión más fuerte que estamos trabajando, ¿verdad? Eso aparte del trabajo local para las organizaciones, como apoyar enteramente la lucha por los derechos de los inmigrantes, ¿verdad? Nada más ayer fuimos a una protesta de que los Minutemen estaban en Civic Center protestando porque San Francisco es una ciudad santuario. Pero ¿y santuario para quiénes, verdad? Porque siguen habiendo redadas, porque siguen habiendo deportaciones con permiso de jóvenes que han sido capturados con el pretexto de las maras, como pasa en El Salvador, y entonces los deportan sin tener un proceso. Entonces, yo creo que ese es uno de las problemáticas más urgentes que hay que solucionar, porque es como, no sé cómo explicarlo, es como una abierta violación a los derechos humanos en nuestras narices. El hecho de que se llevan prácticamente secuestrada a la gente. Muchas veces sus familias no saben dónde están. No, que se fue a Phoenix, no, que se fue a no sé dónde, Texas, no, que... Entonces, ¿y cómo? Eso es un secuestro. Y que el secuestro no es es un delito, ¿acaso? Que la discriminación no es un delito. Es como que yo te lleve a vos y te diga, hey, vos tenés cara de centroamericano, sos ilegal. Eso es falta de respeto, ¿verdad? Eso es una cuestión de que este país habla para afuera de que eso no existe aquí, que aquí es el país de las maravillas, que la discriminación, que la libertad, que el respeto a la diversidad, que todas esas cuestiones, y es mentira, ¿verdad? Entonces tenemos que luchar porque ese discurso se vuelva verdad, porque ese discurso no se quede aquí estancado también, sino que salga y se demuestre en el exterior que sí hay respeto, ¿verdad? Que sí hay respeto a la soberanía de los otros pueblos, que sí hay respeto a la cultura de la gente, ¿verdad? que si no hablas inglés no es problema. No venís de Europa, ¿verdad? Bueno. Entonces, sí, no, solo ya para cerrar, yo creo que la lucha tiene que ser en los dos campos, ¿verdad? En internacional y local. Y ya me callo.
Okay. So some of the work that CISPUS is going to be doing right now is bringing delegations to El Salvador to support and to really truly accompany, not only politically but physically, the social movement's arrival to power. Social movement is poised to take power in El Salvador through means of the elections, and we can send delegations and people from the U.S. to be there with them. Not only that, but to oppose U.S. intervention as U.S. people from El Salvador, in El Salvador's ground. That's a powerful thing. But then also truly to live in our own flesh and feel the real intensity of the crisis and of the power of the social movement in El Salvador now. And so we really have to do this work of breaking off or breaking down the last allies of capitalism and of global terrorism, which there is El Salvador, there's Colombia and Mexico, and that's really the only capitalist allies that the U.S. has left. And then there's the also really key piece of organizing locally in our own communities to really demand the respect and the rights of immigrants. And just yesterday we were at a rally against the Minutemen, who were here in San Francisco in Civic Center, and they are saying that San Francisco is a sanctuary city. But I ask, a sanctuary for whom? Because the raids are still happening, the deportations are still happening. They're deporting juveniles who've been literally captured by the police under the pretext of being a gang member, just like they do in El Salvador. And this is a problem that is absolutely the most urgent for us to solve together, because this is like an open, just flat out violation of our human rights that's just right in our faces. You know, they're practically kidnapping people from their homes. Family members don't know where they are. Did they go to Phoenix? Did they go to Texas? Nobody knows where they are. So they literally are kidnapping people. But that's not a crime. You know, and so what really should be a crime is besides the kidnapping, but this sort of discrimination, the lack of respect that exists, because, you know, outside of the U.S., it doesn't look like that. It's supposedly this, you know, a paradise, this country of really miracles and marvelous things where there's no discrimination, everything is free, there's respect for human rights, for diversity, and that's just a lie. So we need to be aware that this discourse is not only being from within the United States, but also leaving the United States. So we could change that discourse that gets projected outward to be actually one of real respect for people's cultures, for sovereignty of other cultures, and then have that be, you know, the understanding of the United States that gets sent out in the rest of the world. So we have these two struggles that we have to take on internationally and locally.
So I have just a couple of things to add, and I fully agree with everything that's been said so far. One thing is that we need to be more clear about getting away from the complexions, the ethnicity, the language questions as being decisive in who we decide who's our friends and who is our enemies. Just because Barack Obama is African American, I have no expectations that he's going to change the race question in this country or the questions about globalization. So his being elected to office doesn't mean that we sit down and wait for things to change. It means that we have to step up even more in order to make the changes that are necessary. So I think we all need to be very clear that just because someone speaks your language, this is from your country, or maybe is parroting some of your culture, doesn't mean that that's necessarily a person who's working for your best interest. So we need to be clear on what the mechanisms of power are, understand power better, and understand how our being quiet, if not being part of what's going on, helps to keep that power in place. Boycotts, other kinds of things are very powerful mechanisms in order to make a difference. So we should get back to using some of those mechanisms. The other thing that I would want to say is we also need to not allow the status quo to continue to define who our enemies are and who our friends. The formation of gangs is a natural thing. It's happened in human societies since the very beginning. Groups come together in gangs in order to protect themselves from what's going on in the environment. Now, they may need some deeper understanding about what the forces are that are bringing the oppression upon them, but they can learn that and become a very powerful instrument for the community. You have the Lords in Chicago, for example, who started out as the kind of gangs that would prey on the community with drugs and other kinds of things. After getting some education, they became a powerful force against those kinds of things and challenging the status quo. So don't allow the status quo, the media, the folks who are in power to define who our enemies are. We need to get to some kind of understanding of that. And I think there's a long way that we can go in terms of doing that. So we have to begin to be more, in a sense, reflective as well as active. We've got to be active out there doing things in organization, pushing the envelopes, but an important part of that is also sitting down and being reflective. What works, what doesn't work, how should we move forward in a different way? Who are some potential allies that we haven't reached out to that we should reach out to? So these are some basics of organizing that we ought to understand from past history. The other thing from past history that I think we need to understand is we shouldn't set ourselves up to be easily knocked over. And I say that in this sense, that often we try to bring everybody under one umbrella to do, you know, one important thing, and usually under one particular leader. The whole idea about the strong man in history is not a indigenous cultural concept. It's not an indigenous cultural understanding. That's a European understanding about the Superman in history. So to follow one particular person who can be assassinated or knocked over and then the organization falls apart is a false way to organize. We are talking about organizing as communities do indigenously, is we come together and whatever happens, the community decides in some way together, and the community moves together so that one person can't be knocked off and changed where we go. So we also need to get back to a better understanding about that kind of organizing. That's what went on in Seattle. That's why the police weren't able to stop what was going on in Seattle. That's why some of the so-called terrorists in the Middle East have been so successful, because there isn't no command structure. So you can't just knock out the command structure and end it. There's things going on all over the place, even when there's no communication. So there needs to be that kind of understanding. Surely there needs to be communication and sharing of what goes on, because if we look at historically, we find that the things that go on in one country fighting against oppression, we hear about in another country, and it inspires movement in those other countries. So there clearly needs to be that kind of discussion, but we need to be more serious about understanding...